Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another special edition of the Four Seasons Fire American Soccer Show, as we are going to have a special report discussion about the status of our youth soccer national teams, as well as the whole pay-to-play situation, if we can get to that as well. But, you know, mainly the main crux, of course, is the future of our players performing on the national team and at a level that we hope to have them prepared for these big under 17 tournaments and under 20 tournaments, including the up and coming Olympic qualifiers, in CONCACAF, to see where and how our national teams are going to be ranked and judged on the international level. Carter Krishnar is supposed to join us. Unfortunately, he's still over at Soccer X in downtown Miami, so he'll be unavailable. We'll have Chris Kessel from the West Virginia Soccer State Association with us in a matter of moments. But joining me right now is, of course, the Soccer Minnow site, my good friend Robert Hay in our nation's capital in the Washington, D.C. area. And we're going to talk about this, and then we'll wait for Mr. Kessel to join us to have a conversation. So, Robert, good evening, and how are you?
Good evening, Daniel. I'm happy to be on, as always. Thank you for inviting me on and having me. And, yeah, this is a topic near and dear to my heart, so I'm looking forward to mixing it up and getting into a good conversation about the future of the youth soccer setup in the U.S.
Well, here's the thing, Robert. First of all, I'm glad you're with us tonight and we're with me tonight. We'll have, of course, again, Chris Kessel later on. You know, the thing that really bothers me right now within the youth soccer circles of American soccer, especially from the U.S. Soccer Federation, as everybody knows, this year it was both the U.S. The Under 20 World Cup that was being played in the summertime. I believe it was in France, but I could be wrong. I forget where that was, but. In the I think the tournament has just wrapped up. I don't know who won the Under 17 World Cup, and which was down in Brazil. The United States, in three group stage matches, scored only one goal, converted only one point, dropped eight of them to teams where the truth is, I felt, look, you can't take it too seriously, but at the same time, you worry, Robert, about the future of our players for this national team. And at the same time, you're wondering where the direction is going towards, because this scares me. And I'm not blaming the kids. They tried their best. They tried their hardest to get the necessary results to advance into the knockout stages, especially in the second round. But to me, I'm getting worried, Robert, that our youth national teams are not going to be as successful in a World Cup, and they may not be successful if they do qualify for the top World Cup for their, you know, for the senior side of the men's national team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you mentioned, you know, Kardik won't be joining us tonight. Now, so since he won't be joining us, I'll steal one of his points that I know he's made on the show before, which is, you know, the interesting thing about the U.S. Versus European participation in tournaments like the U-17 World Cup is, you know, the U.S. and CONCACAF take it a little bit more seriously, and other federations take it a little bit more seriously than UEFA does. I mean, That's, I think, maybe changing a little bit, but, you know, we always see this as kind of a measuring stick tournament, whereas some other nations may not. So for us, you know, if we were a European country, we might not care as much, but because we put so much stock in results, you know, the results are set as a kind of the marker for the development of our U team. So instead of things like players brought in or, you know, other metrics that may be used to measure the success of our U teams, it's wins and losses. And of course, we didn't perform in U17. We haven't performed in other tournaments in the past. And, you know, we see these things through wins and losses. And it may seem like a really stupid thing to say in the terms of, you know, well, of course, soccer is a sport. Wins and losses is the ultimate determinant. It's not how you play the game. But when we're talking about youth soccer, and even at the most competitive youth levels, winning is important, but it's not the most important thing necessarily. The most important thing really is are you developing a pool of players that will eventually form your senior pool and compete for your senior pool and give you the ability to pick the best players for your senior pool? So a lot of times, if you're doing things like bringing in a diverse group of players, cycling through different players, you know, trying out different things that may work and discarding things that don't work in terms of formations, tactics, players playing with one another. You know, if you're a good country with a good setup, you'll still win, but there will be times when you don't, you know, play well in a tournament or a Youth World Cup, and that's fine. It's not the end of the world. You may have learned something from it. So my concern with the U.S. U setup is, you know, we hear about these U17 teams, these U20 teams, you know, you pick your age group. And if they do well in the World Cup, it's great. If we don't do well, you know, we discard it. But, you know, how many of these players do we feel confident are going to be the backbone of our senior national team? So the U17 tournament, we're talking about 16-year-olds or so. In 8 years, if I can do my math, 7 years, 6 or 7 years when we host the World Cup, these are going to be the young players that are going to hopefully form the, if not the backbone, but certainly the depth or contribute greatly to the senior team. So I guess my question is, yes, it's not great that they didn't perform well. And the other question following that up is, you know, do we think that they are developing such a way that these players will be contributors to the senior team when we host the World Cup? And I don't know if the tournament, you know, if the World Cup showed us that. I don't think we've seen a lot from our youth setup that gives us a lot of confidence in general about the future coming through. I mean, we certainly know there are young players that are playing well, and we name names, but a lot of these younger players that are playing well are getting senior team call-ups. So that's a very long-winded way of saying wins don't always matter, but when winning is your only metric, then they do matter. And I think it is a concerning time for the youth setup in U.S. soccer.
Well, the one thing that kind of bothers me, and once again, the Under-17 World Cup that just ended, hosted by Brazil, was actually won by Brazil. So amazingly, only the senior side in two World Cups have not won the World Cup on home soil. So I guess the Under-17s make up for that for the moment. But, you know, what really bothers me is that you have some of these players on the Under-17s that play for clubs in Major League Soccer. And the one player that is being talked about a lot, possibly a transfer to maybe, you know, Italy, maybe to Fiorentina, or to another Italian club that maybe is in a lower, you know, in a lower league. But the truth is, Robert, Gianluca Busio, who is basically a kid developed by Sporting Kansas City, and ever since he's been, you know, subbed in to any matches for Sporting Kansas City, he's converted. He's been nonstop, you know, coming off the substitutes bench, burying chances out of nowhere, and he's been perfect for Sporting Kansas City. Yet, I find it hard to believe that. How I feel about him on this Under-17 World Cup, I don't think he was nervous. I just think he was played out of position. And I think, you know, that's the detriment of some of these players right now, you know, 17 and under, that either are being played out of position or, you know, maybe the coach doesn't know what he's doing.
or again, the emphasis is on the result. I mean, we still.
Shit. Sorry about that, folks. Go ahead, Robert.
No worries. Am I on? Oh, no,
you're
no worries.
I made a mistake, but go ahead. You're
okay.
Good.
No worries.
That's my fault.
All right. Rewind. Let's do this.
Rewind.
I think you even see this at the senior level, too. I mean, you know, Christian Pulisic plays, you know, at least when he was with Borussia Dortmund, played out of position in terms of where he played with club versus country. Arguably, since he was the U.S.'s, you know, most, you know, had the most skill, you know, playing kind of that central role fits the team. But I mean, this is a tradition within the U.S. It's a matter of fitting players to get the result, not fitting your system or coming up with your metrics to fit the player. So yeah, I agree with you. I mean, Busio's, you know, when you look at the score sheet from an otherwise forgettable U17, his name pops out left and right. So but again, this happens a lot with the U.S. I mean, it's this idea of, you know, we're not going to worry about club. We're not going to worry about, you know, how they develop four. We're going to worry about what gets us the result. And is it more important to beat Senegal, or is it to find players playing in their position to figure out, you know, next year and the year after when they move up, hopefully, you know, is this where they're going to play? Well, you know, I think the answer is obviously, like you said, it's the result. And when you don't get the result, again, you're failing twice.
No, I agree. And let me just say this. I think results are always important. I think results always show the building of a national team getting bigger, getting better, getting stronger. I think what needs to be done, though, is that you want to put these kids in a position to succeed. As long as these kids are performing at a high level, as long as they are playing hard and being put in proper positioning, then, in my opinion, then the kid can ascend to the under-20s, and then maybe that kid gets another opportunity. He can go to the Olympic qualifiers. But until then, at this point in time, you know, is it the board? Is it, you know, coaching? Is it something is the player pool thinned out? I mean, I don't know what's going on, but the truth is that what I saw in three group stage matches, terrible loss against Senegal, I thought a very solid defensive effort. They got a scoreless draw, and that saved them for a possibility of going into, you know, facing the Dutch, who got eliminated two matches, and then they got a lifeline, a slim lifeline to go into the knockout stage, and that took the U.S. out of it because the Dutch just basically blitzed them.
Yeah, I think we also have to tip our hat to the fact that the U.S. group stage, I know this isn't the senior teams, but, I mean, you're talking about three footballing nations, even Japan at this point, who now have a tradition of developing young players, good young players, and both for, you know, club and country. In terms of, you know, where you want to point the fingers, you know, I certainly think that there's been a tradition in U.S. coaching of results, again, results over development, and I don't think this is uncommon just to the U.S. national team coaches. I think you see this in U.S. coaching, I won't say in general, but in a lot of places in the game, in the development academies and things like that. It's this reward of wins and, you know, this reward of making players look good or trying to make yourself look good by moving players around and maybe outsmarting yourself. I think that it's a combination of the player pool is not where we want it to be. And it's the coaches, you know, are taught to develop players a certain way. And I think that's, you know, getting the results and not necessarily thinking what they're doing with club and country and, you know, having those two data sets figure out what the best is best for the player. It's just seeing them and ignoring kind of what they're doing for their club and figuring out what you want them to do for country. You know, I know you probably don't want to go down this route now, but I'll bring this up now. You know, the statistics that are coming out now about youth soccer and participation in youth sports in general are pretty damning. I mean, there's a massive drop-off in terms of players who start playing soccer and all sports, but especially soccer at a young age, and then just drop the game before they turn 14. And I think that a lot of times the reason for that is what we see reflected at the highest level, which is this results-oriented, non-skill development type of coaching that these players receive, which is, you know, you get the players that are playing their best at the moment, you put them in a position where your team is going to win, and you figure that how they're playing now is how they will continue to play. And as we know with young players, that's not always the case. I mean, we're talking right now about U16, U17 players. And I said earlier, these are the players that, you know, should be forming the depth of your World Cup host, when you host the World Cup, the team that hosts the World Cup. In reality, though, a lot of these players for the U17 aren't going to make the senior team. I mean, that's just the nature of youth soccer. But really what the U.S. Soccer Federation should be doing is putting these players in the best position to succeed and to figure out, you know, build a deep talent pool and give exposure to enough players that when the time comes, they don't have to play the next Christian Pulisic or, you know, the next Tim Ream or, you know, name other players, the senior team that have played out of position. You know, the next player they need to play out of position because they're lacking depth. Because these teams tend to focus on the same core group of players, and they try and fit them in where the coaches try and fit them into the positions of need, and instead of developing a deeper pool of players where they can bring in another player or two or three or four players to fill the need that they have. Hopefully that diatribe made sense.
And
it's more of an idea of depth,
no, it does,
rather than, yeah.
No, it does. And the thing is, this is what I think. We want to try and make sure we understand, you know, that you want these kids that want to get involved in the game. You know, it's a combination of make sure the coaches don't put too much pressure on them and, you know, at the same time, can't have their parents. And I think this goes for everyone that gets involved with youth sports. Stop assuming your child is going to be the next, you know, Lionel Messi or the, you know, or if it's in baseball, like the next Derek Jeter, you know, or the next Ryan Zimmerman or something like that. You know, got to go out there and let them be who they want to be. And if they want to pretend to be, you know, one of, like you know, the great players of the certain sport that they root for.
Well, hold on. I'm going to interrupt you right there because that's not how the system is set up. I mean, think of it this way. Look at how our system is set up now. The Soccer Federation has – and well, let's talk about the guy side at the moment because that's kind of what we're talking about, although this is increasingly applying to the women's side, the girl side. You've got a development academy system that's tied to the MLS – basically tied to MLS teams. And increasingly, the U.S. Soccer Federation is muscling out independent development academies and independent clubs that are developing players and – funneling players through MLS clubs and the, you know, the preordained clubs and academies. So you have a system where, as a young player, you have a goal in mind. I mean, there's not 100 ways to get to be a U.S. youth soccer player. There's three or four paths. I mean, you're limited by geography. You're limited by club. So you can't go to, you know, Polk County Soccer Association and make the Olympic team. That's not how it works anymore. You've got to go through the Chicago Fire Academy or DC United Academy or some, you know, an MLS academy to get a sniff. And so what U.S. Soccer has done in this creation of this narrow pyramid is, you know, really cut down on the ways that they can find talent. And so when we talk about the kids and the parents, yes, parents and the youth soccer players certainly deserve some of the blame, especially those who, you know, all they do is spend time with a soccer ball or any other sport. But it's also the fault of the federation, which says if you're 13 and you're not in the development track, you know, have fun playing in high school and college and maybe getting a scholarship because you ain't sniffing the senior team. I mean, maybe you go to Europe and you get discovered, you know, you get rediscovered that way. But the pathways are really narrowing for players more so than they should. And I think that is reflected on the players, the parents, the coaches. I mean, it trickles down to our entire youth system, which is, you know, you've got a slim shot and you've got to really take advantage of that slim shot when you're 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 and put all of your efforts into, you know, getting one of those academy slots. So it's a really dysfunctional system at this point, which rewards those kids who get in early and stay on the track rather than, you know, kids who may develop late or kids who may find the right club for them that helps them develop or, you know, there is no alternative path except to go to Europe and to succeed there. And we're seeing that with some kids. But mm-hmm. I think that U.S. soccer doesn't reward parents or kids who may do the right thing, which is just develop.
And hopefully we have on Chris Kessel from the West Virginia State Soccer Association. Chris, are you there? No, not yet. So we'll just have to wait for Chris to join us a little bit later. Thought we had him, but I guess the connection didn't get through. And I agree with you, Robert. I mean, look, you want to give all these kids an opportunity to, you know, get a taste of playing in the international level. But, you know, once again, it depends on the environment you have to be in, I guess, you know, to be with an MLS club. I mean, how many players have we seen so far in MLS that grows up with an academy system, especially like the New York Red Bulls? DC United finally getting a USL team in Loudoun County. Pardon me. And then, of course, you got Sporting Kansas City with Swope Park Rangers. Of course, you know, now almost every club in MLS has a USL team, and, you know, we'll talk about that in another time. But still, though, you know, you're seeing these kids getting the opportunities to play for a club that's going to be considered an under-17 opportunity for the future. And still, though, I just feel like, Robert, and I understand where you're coming from, and I don't blame you for feeling like that, but, you know, still, though, what is the problem with the scouting then? I mean, is it the scouting issues come from U.S. soccer? Is the scouting issues coming from maybe some of these MLS clubs? I mean, I know the Red Bulls do these development camps before they get an mm-hmm. opportunity to, if they do get picked, to get into the academy, then they move on to the USL League 2 system, which is formerly the PDL. And then if they do well for PDL, then they move up to USL Championship League right now. And then, of course, if they're good enough to get to the MLS, then off they go.
So I will not take credit for this. I will give all the credit to Soccer America, because there was an article in Soccer America about 2 or 3 weeks ago where they met, where they talked to a longtime Midwestern U.S. scout. And the genesis of the article was there was a few youth players who were the Mexico Federation was courting heavily. And these are kids who basically were developed in the U.S. They played club soccer in the U.S. and they were within, you know, a couple hundred miles of a development academy, but these kids are being checked out by Mexico and really being recruited hard, and they're probably going to end up in the Mexico youth setup. And the interview with this scout was, you know, how did we miss these kids? I mean, these are kids who grew up in the U.S., played in recognizable, well-known clubs. Even though they're not academy clubs, they're well-known clubs. And he said these kids were not invited to the U.S. soccer, basically the tryouts, the U.S. soccer tryouts for the academy team. And because they couldn't make these tryouts, I apologize, I'm blanking on the word, basically these shows, you know, the where you have the kids show off their skills.
Right.
They fell off the radar. And he said, it's ridiculous. He said, I see kids like this all the time, and if they don't show up to these U.S. soccer-sanctioned events, they're considered persona non grata. And I think if you mention the scouting, I mean, let's assume that this is the case. You have basically this federation that over-relies on its setup to find kids. And as you've said, we're finding some, but we're not finding enough, or we're not finding all of them. And I think it's, you know, probably a big part of it is we don't – the federation doesn't trust third-party clubs or third-party systems, and it just basically says, if you're good enough, you're going to come to us. And I think the worst part about that is it's not like the U.S. Soccer Federation is hurting for money. I mean, we all know about the infamous, you know, $100 million reserve fund, which, you know, I'm not as hard on them about that as others are. But you've got money where you can create a scouting system that isn't reliant only upon your development academies. But if the interview is to be believed, and I think there is an element of truth to it based on other things I've heard, you know, they're basically relying on their own setup to find players. And that's not enough. In a country of 300 million where, you know, millions of kids are playing youth soccer every year, it's not enough to sit there and say the 50 or 60 kids we bring into each development academy tryout, you know, are the ones that we're going to be looking at for the national team, plus kids that are in Europe that we see.
Absolutely, and that's really tough. Speaking about that, of course, now he is on with us, Chris Kessel, member of the West Virginia State Soccer Association. And Chris, you know, obviously West Virginia does their best to develop kids and gets them ready to play this game. And of course, there's always going to be moments with the independent, you know, semi-pro clubs that goes on. I mean, West Virginia, I believe, does have a USL League Two team somewhere in the state, but I could be wrong. Maybe it's not around anymore. But still, though, you know, how tough is it to get someone from the main offices of U.S. Soccer in Chicago to come to West Virginia, under 17 head coach, to scout any of your players, whether it be boys or girls?
It's actually impossible. We actually had Dante Hawkins played on the U16 national team in the Nike friendlies, you know, last week or 2 weeks ago now. And, he was the very first kid from West Virginia to ever earn a youth national team cap. And the only way that happened is his club team played in a tournament in Pennsylvania, and the Philadelphia Union brought him in, and he had to move to Philadelphia from West Virginia and played in the Philly Union Academy. And played for Bethlehem Steel a little bit and made the youth national team that way. So the only way that he was able to, you know, enter the system was moving 5 or 6 hours away from where he grew up. I mean, it was that simple. It was pack up and move. You know, there was no other way for him to be able to enter the system. And, you know, that it just – and we do still have USL League Two team, they're called FC Alliance. They're here in Charleston, but rural areas and smaller cities all around the country that don't have DAs are, in my opinion, purposely excluded from the system. I mean, you know, the only way that you can say otherwise is to attribute it to malfeasance. You know, if we're only going to scout the DA, you know, then that means we're purposely excluding everybody else. And if we're excluding everybody else for some other reason, I mean, what is it? Gross incompetence? I mean, you know, I don't know what else that you can attribute it to. But I overheard, you know, in the last this little discussion point right there where he said that, you know, U.S. Soccer says you're either going to join us and – you know, participate in the way that we tell you to participate, or you're not going to get to participate. And that's 100% true.
So let me ask you this, though, Chris. Would it be prudent, or maybe, I guess, cost-effective, if possible, to have U.S. Soccer allow to hire a scout within each soccer state association's, whether it be, you know, West Virginia or the Eastern New York, Western New York? I know Pennsylvania has East and West as well, or California, North and South. You know, to at least have a couple of scouts hired by, you know, either through U.S. Soccer or hired by your own state association, but they represent U.S. Soccer, to find these kids that could possibly do well on a national team to go forward and to qualify for a World Cup and performing well in a World Cup?
Well, you know, that's a couple great ideas. I think lots of people put forth all kinds of wonderful ideas. I mean, there are so many different ways that U.S. Soccer could use existing systems and structures to scout. You know, if they hired a few more scouts, you know, that were full-time, or they gave some sort of, you know, stipend to state associations and they supported, you know, U.S. club soccer, you know, regional team, you know, system, or helped fund the ODP system to try to bolster it up for U.S. youth soccer participants, along with scouting the DA, you know, that would give us lots of different avenues for players from lots of different communities to still participate in the system, to enter the system, and to get looked at by people who were, you know, trained, you know, by U.S. soccer. So I know that they just started having, you know, a scouting licensure program. And, you know, if there were hundreds and hundreds of scouts, you know, like I like to call it, I think that everybody in the United States understands what the informal scouting network is, because, you know, they all knew the kid that they grew up with that was a star basketball player when they were like 13 or 14. Everybody talked about him. The high school coach knew about him before he showed up or she showed up, because all of the other coaches talked about him, and they all, like, helped funnel these kids, you know, the correct direction. And if we were out here creating all of these different networks and had all of this informal scouting network set up, you know, all across the country, instead of saying the only way you can be seen is by, you know, driving 4 hours to go to the DA, but instead we had all of these different avenues that were created so that the informal scouting network that already exists, because I know what kids are the best ones here in the Kanawha Valley. I mean, I go and watch a whole lot of kids play soccer. You know, every weekend I see it. So I know who's good. So if U.S. soccer brought somebody here and talked to a bunch of coaches, we would tell them, you need to go see so-and-so and so-and-so. You know, those are the two best players. And use the resources, because they're – every person on this call, I mean, on this, you know, on the conversation tonight, wants to see U.S. soccer do well. And if a scout showed up in town and they talked to us, we're not going to hide the information, you know. Use the informal scouting network. Go and see people at all these different venues. You know, create a better scouting network, whether you have to do it directly by hiring scouts through U.S. soccer and positioning them regionally. You know, hire one for the Ohio Valley and hire one for, you know, whatever, you know, the greater Cleveland area, and hire one, you know, whatever you have to do. Or, you know, use the state associations to house them and have them scout, you know, the region, even if it's U.S. Club, you know, or U.S., you know, USSSA, or, you know, or USYS or whatever. You know, just use the things that are already in place to find these kids and to engage the entire community, the U.S. soccer, you know, youth soccer community. You know, just use all these tools. But they don't want to use – I mean, it just seems like they don't want to use the tools. Like you said, they want you to do it their way and only their way. They've dictated to everybody exactly how it's going to work instead of allowing everybody to participate.
And Robert, it sounds like the Developmental Academy through U.S. Soccer has become a hindrance, it looks like. I mean, it really looks like that, you know, the only way you're going to get your kid recognized, or at least recognized through an MLS side, is if, you know, they're part of this Development Academy networking that, you know, you don't know who you're going to bring over. I mean, sure, not to say, like, you know, this player – was a part of the Developmental Academy, you know, for DC United, yet there's another player out there that's probably from a youth club or playing in high school, and he doesn't get in because he didn't go through the normal channels, you might say, that U.S. soccer has adapted to try to, you know, find these kids to make our, you know, youth national team better and, you know, trying to hunt for Olympic medals, at least a gold medal if possible, Robert.
So I want to answer your question by piggybacking off of something Chris said, because that was an incredibly enlightening and informative answer to your questions. But there's an element here that he touched on, and I'd also like to hear his thoughts on this after I comment on it, which is the centrality of the DA system. So we were just talking about a kid who would travel to Philadelphia, you know, for a game, was spotted by the Union, is had to go play for the Union's DA. Daniel, you and actually I think probably all of us on this call are lucky enough that we live in an area of the country where it would be an inconvenience if we had a kid who had to go move to another city to play in a DA. So if I had a kid who was spotted by the Union DA, could I move to Philadelphia if I had to? Sure, I could move to Philadelphia if I had to. What if you're a kid in Oklahoma, or what if you're a kid in Nevada, or what if you're a second generation immigrant from a kid whose family immigrated to the U.S. in less than ideal circumstances? I mean, this brings in the other factor of pay to play that we hear talked about a lot in the U.S. setup. And I think pay to play is a little bit of a misnomer, but for a lot of people, you have to have a significant both source of income and the ability to be mobile in your lifestyle in order to respond to this setup. I mean, it's unless you live next door to a DA, and again, I'm lucky because DC United's here. If I had a kid that was eligible, it wouldn't be that big of a hardship for me. But there's a lot of people out there who are playing soccer, whose kids are playing soccer, and it's not just the fact that they have to go get spotted by DA, but they would have to uproot their lifestyle potentially to adjust to the U.S. soccer system. And so I think that's another element we'd have to bring up as well is, as a country as large as ours, to limit the access point limits the ability of a large number of people to participate simply due to geography and finances. So I think that's the point. That's how I want to answer your question, is to also bring up that point, which is that's another hindrance that we need to bring up as well, is this financial aspect of it.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. When we talk about pay to play, there's so many different levels to what that actually encompasses. The training fees are one thing. The club, like Philadelphia or DC United, in most cases, those are free. But that doesn't cover, housing if you're not from the area, travel, especially if you live, you read the stories all the time about these kids driving, 2 and 3 hours to train, because they live, 150 miles away from the academy that they play for. I mean, think of the time commitment that they have to put into that, and the money that it costs to travel. And then the travel to go all over the place, because unless you're playing for, DC United or Houston Dynamo or whatever, your parents have to get you to all these far-flung places to play games. Even if you don't play in a DA, some of the pay-to-play clubs here, in West Virginia play in the National League, and they play in the Great Lakes Regional League. So they're going to Vegas and they're going to St. Louis and wherever for games. I mean, that costs a lot of money. That's more expensive than the training fees. That adds up to an astronomical number. And those are the things that also, what happens if you have the best 13-year-old in the country? The best 2006 right now. They're getting ready to next year, enter the U.S. Youth National Team scene. But they just can't afford to keep playing at the level that would be commiserate to their talent. And they live in Iowa, and they're the best 13-year-old in the country. But they're never going to get a play with U.S. Youth National Team because they don't have an MLS DA near them that's going to allow it to be free. So they're going to continue playing in the Iowa State League and playing for state cups and whatever. And there we go. That's where all this stuff is. There's so many different layers, to this problem. And, none of the easy solutions solve them. Because even though I have, and I think all of us have problems with, the Federation, if there were easy solutions to these problems, they would do them, you know. And it's going to take lots of work and lots of effort and changes, you know, at a structural level to how we do soccer in this country to help more kids play and to find more very talented players and bring them into the system. And that's going to take work and money and, you know, not being conservative, not to think, well, if we just make this little tweak here and this little tweak there, that it's going to solve these problems. We have to have big, bold solutions for them.
Yeah, I mean, there has to be some form of solution, and everything is unfortunately tied to money. Money makes the world go round. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, a boy playing this game or a girl playing this game. You know, you got to go out there, and, you know, you're trying to show your best, and sadly, unfortunately, you know, there's always going to be limitations because, you know, I would like to think, gentlemen, that the way that life is these days – your kid could probably be the greatest thing since sliced bread. Not trying to, you know, be derogatory or anything like that, but you know, you gotta make it, you gotta show an example somewhere. But as I was saying, you know, if you think, you know, your kid is gonna be the next great player, you know, the next great Landon Donovan, you know, the next great Tyler Adams, or the next great whoever, you know. Maybe you have your own Paul Caligiuri shot heard around the world moment. You know, you want to give these kids an opportunity to, you know, get the same level and the same look like an academy kid that is from an MLS academy to, you know, to get out there and, you know, get out there and show what they can do. Because, you know, we've seen many times in other youth sports tournaments, especially in ice hockey, of course, the world, the junior championships are coming up again this next month in December. And you see kids that are playing on national teams that are either coming from, especially from U.S. soccer, I mean from U.S. USA Hockey, you know, if they're not playing for an NHL team or for you know, an AHL team that is represented by an NHL team, you know, they'll come from college. From the college games, and of course, you know, most of the players for Canada are either coming from the you know, junior hockey or from the NHL teams that are in Canada. In Europe, it's either from you know, a professional, you know, say a Swedish club, and then of course we don't know if it's that there's a Swedish national team, you know, for youth games, you know, how they get all set up. But you know, everyone gets selected if they come from either a professional team, a collegiate side, a university side, or, you know, junior hockey. And to me, it sounds like, Robert, that U.S. soccer, or, you know, the lack thereof from U.S. soccer, is just only worrying about the kids that are either, okay, we'll do it your way, or oh, we'll just go to the MLS sides and see what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think Chris hit the nail on the head. It takes bold leadership and thought. I mean, I think the good thing about the U.S. Soccer Federation is it has money. I mean, it has the ability to make bold decisions, not only because, you know, it's been stocking money in its reserves and, you know, it does a aggressive fundraising through the U.S. Soccer Foundation, but it's got a number of lucrative corporate partnerships, you know, some Nike, you know, all these Target, all these other corporations are putting a lot of money into it. So I think there's an ability there that, unlike some countries that may not have the resources to do this, they can spend some money and be aggressive or be creative. So while we were talking, I went to the U.S. Soccer Foundation website and just did a quick search about, you know, top priorities or top, you know, fundraising initiatives, and the three that popped up focused mostly on access to the game. So the ability to build soccer pitches in different communities and expand the opportunity to play soccer in you know, inner cities and other places. So basically, the U.S. Soccer Foundation, at least on its first couple pages focuses on the idea of expanding the game for all to play. And I think that's certainly, I mean, I think we can all agree that's a very laudable goal. But it's that next step that I think is where it's lacking and what we've been talking about, which is, okay, we're getting kids to play. It's how do we get kids to continue to play and to continue to play at a high level. And then once we see those kids that we know can play at a higher level, how do we get them to that higher level? You know, it's not, you know, the idea of having a soccer academy where kids were flown into Florida and housed didn't work out. So, but there's enough money there to experiment on other things in order to bridge that gap between everyone's playing soccer and we're taking a small percentage and turning them into the U.S. national team pool. So how do we bridge that gap? And I think it's certainly those questions were asked during the U.S. Soccer Federation election. To an extent, they weren't really answered, but I think that's the kind of question that people need to keep asking, which is you've got the resources, you've got the people, you've got the expertise, you've got the money. Now, U.S. Soccer Federation, you've got to bridge that gap between the kids playing and the kids you have in your setup. How do you get transition that millions and millions of kids who now have access to soccer to make sure you have more of them coming into the national team setup?
Well, you know, Robert, the only way to keep kids from playing soccer, and of course, you know, back in the days when New York City FC was just fledgling, how they wanted to build a floating pitch. And Chris, I can see that happening by the Kanawha River, if you don't mind. You know, why not? I mean, that'd be the greatest spectacle ever in Charleston, West Virginia, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Look, you know, you're exactly right. I mean, we want to keep as many kids playing at as high a level as they can possibly play. And if the Federation did a better job of facilitating, you know, events where they could scout and they could bring in, you know, quality club teams, you know, along with the DA, along with, you know, every possible thing that they could for events that they could keep them low cost and they were very regional and they could bring the scouts in and they could look at a lot of kids and they weren't a tournament setting. They were a showcase setting. Like, I mean, just while you were talking right there, I mean, some of the things that popped into my head were like, why do we not have, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 like age group showcases all around the country where we bring in state cup champions and runner ups and, you know, U.S. club regional champions and the DA teams from those regions and just play a game, you know, a weekend full of games with U.S. soccer scouts there, you know, so that they could identify players that are missed from the system and do it all around the country so that, you know, you didn't have to fly, you know, to Florida to be seen if you're from North Dakota. You know, you just have to drive over to Minnesota and you got two or three states worth of, you know, the highest quality teams that you have so that you can find missed kids. And, you know, you do that through the state association or through US Club or through the DA, whoever's got fields. And, you know, you can also bring in the best referees and, you know, because I know that we talk about, you know, a lot of people talk about that. We talk about that in West Virginia all the time is how do we get better referees? Because without better referees, it's really hard to have better players. You know, if they're out there getting hacked down every weekend, it's hard to be a skillful, talented player, you know, and having these events where we can bring in young referees and young players and make everybody better and find better referees and find the best youth players and, you know, that's the kind of stuff that the Federation could be doing right now with that reserve, you know, and that would allow if, you know, a lot of people say that it's not, you know, but if the DA is the highest quality youth soccer there is in this country, why would we not want to bring other teams in to play against them that are the best of the rest? so that they can continue to grow and develop by playing the best teams also. You know, it seems like if they wanted to use these reserves and they actually wanted to find more kids and they actually wanted to help develop them, you know, give them the ability to develop and the you know, the proper, you know, situations to develop, and they wanted to find more, you know, give proper situations for referees to showcase themselves and learn with the best youth players in the country, they could.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Chris, I wanted to ask you this. You know, Robert, of course, is in the Washington, D.C. area. Of course, D.C. United is there. They have their USL club in Loudoun United. Obviously, you know, where I am, you know, in northern New Jersey, New York City's not far. They got the New York Red Bulls in Harrison, New Jersey. Of course, obviously, New York City FC plays in Yankee Stadium in the Bronx. Has there ever been any conversations, or if you are aware of anyone, you know, thinking about bringing over either a higher-leveled club in whether it be USL League One, USL Championship, or even, dare I say it, you know, maybe bring MLS to at least to Charleston, West Virginia, and, you know, possibly building a stadium in downtown Charleston to entice the league to at least, you know, they say they want to go to 32 teams, and, you know, there's still three spots available. You know,
well,
would West Virginia?
I do know that USL has been here. I actually know the investor that owns the USL League Two team here, and I know for a fact that USL came here. We actually have. It's not downtown, but we have two soccer-specific stadiums here. One holds about 3,200, and one holds a little over 2,000. That are ready to go right now if they ever decided to move FC Alliance Pro. And I know that USL came here. Well, for one, they tweeted out that they were here on a visit. And then when I saw the gentleman, I asked him about it. So I don't know how far that's went from there, but I do know that the discussion did happen about USL League One.
Okay, well, that's good. That's very good. I'm very glad to hear that. I mean, I know that you got a minor league baseball team that's affiliated with the Pittsburgh Pirates and the West Virginia Power over, you know, you got that ballpark in downtown Charleston in West Virginia.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, obviously you want to keep it like soccer-specific, the stadium. We already have enough, you know, minor league ballparks being used for soccer stadiums, including – the big ballpark in the Bronx, which, you know, hopefully they'll get out of sooner or later. But still, though, that's the hope, you know, want to see, the smaller towns getting an opportunity to, you know, host, you know, whether it be a USL higher level league, if it's League One or, you know, Championship League, we'll see what happens. But, you know, Robert, I think that's the one thing I think we're missing is that when you watch the Premier League, Robert, and you see like Huddersfield or, you know, if I'm pronouncing it correctly or incorrectly, please let me know, Macclesfield Town in the Premier League. You have these small little towns that has these big sized, like, you know, Premier League MLS size stadiums in a town that's probably a couple of thousand. But yet, the, you know, the ground is like, you know, oh, we can handle 25 to 30,000 people. You know, do you think that's what something West Virginia can try and do, or at least the smaller towns and smaller cities in our country?
Well, I 100% think that when we're able to engage every smaller city all across the country, that's when the sport actually explodes. You know, I know that we have tons of youth participation, and we have lots of people that really live and breathe the game, but we haven't been able to properly, you know, bring everybody together to love local soccer. And when we're able to have these teams in every community all across the country, you know, that's when we'll be able to properly engage, you know, every community. And that's when, I mean, it's, think about high school football. I mean, you know, that's every community loving football. And then, you know, think about college sports. You know, what, I mean, how, what is there, 300 and, you know, 340 or something Division I college basketball teams. You know, that's why the NCAA tournament is so big, because basically every city in America has a, you know, college basketball. You know, if you're, you know, a community of any size or stature, you have college basketball. So everybody feels like they are a part of it. You know, soccer, everybody's not a part of it. You know, like, even if you live, you know, just a couple hours south of Washington, D.C., and, you know, over near, you know, the Tidewater area in Virginia, like, what is your development pathway as a player? If you play midget league football, you know that your pathway to the NFL is, I'm going to play for my local U10 team. Then when I'm 12, I'm going to play for my middle school team. Then I'm going to go play for my high school. Then I'm going to go play for UVA or Virginia Tech. And then I'm going to the NFL. They know exactly the pathway. And it's the same pathway for basketball. What does that kid feel like their development pathway is for soccer? Nobody knows. The parents don't know. You know, the kids don't know. Nobody knows. When every community has a team, you know, a first team, a men's and a women's first team, then they go, oh, I'm going to play in the academy, and then I'm going to play for the U18s, and then I'm going to break through, you know, when I'm 18 years old, and I'm going to get first team minutes, and then blah, blah. When they know that pathway, that's when kids will start dreaming, you know, about being the best, not just some kids, not kids just in first, you know, soccer first households, but every kid that plays soccer will dream about being the best player in America. You know, your dad didn't have to love basketball for you to know the pathway, and didn't have to, you know, for you to dream about being in the NBA. But right now, you know, most kids that dream about being the best player in the country, you know, their parents care a lot about the game also. And they figure out and navigate the broken pathway that we have, you know, for players to, you know, make their way to the top. When we have it so that every community has this pathway, this stair step of how you make it from my first game when I was six to the first team, that's when we'll see, you know, big time change and big time involvement from communities like Charleston and like Des Moines and Portland, Maine, and, you know, all these communities that right now are kind of locked out of the system, you know, even though they have USL League 2 or MPSL or whatever, they're pretty much locked out of the system. When we are able to have that in every community, we'll see big time cultural change around the game, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you there. But I want, Robert, your opinion about this situation. What did you think about that?
I'm sorry, about which one specifically?
With, you know, like you know, maybe like, you know, like West Virginia, you know, like what Chris just said. I mean, they have a USL League 2 team. They're, the USL bigwigs came over to see, you know, maybe they can move up a professional level, either League 1 or the Championship League. I mean, you know, like I was saying before, Robert, you know, we see like in the Premier League, whether it's on, you know, whether it be you know, a Premier League team, or if you're watching a Championship League team in England, or when you're watching the FA Cup, you have these small towns like Macclesfield Town, which is like maybe 5,000 to 7,000 people, yet they have a professional soccer stadium that's like, you know, 25,000 to 30,000 seats, you know, that everyone can get to.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, like, you know, excuse me.
Yeah.
I mean, could you
it's
see?
It's interesting you
like,
brought up
Charleston,
Macclesfield though,
that's
because. Well, it's interesting you brought up Macclesfield because they're actually undergoing some financial difficulties right now. And I think that's one of the interesting things about – one of the big cautions from the England model, which is, you know, we've seen in recent years a number of clubs either, you know, spend more than they can bring in or not be able to live up to the professional obligation simply due to the increasing demand of professional soccer in England. So on one respect, the English model is a warning sign for the U.S. in the future. But, I mean, I can't disagree with what Chris said. I mean, I think this idea of if every community had, you know, a good soccer club that was well-run, well-organized, or at least, you know, looked out for the best interest of the kids. And, you know, there was a system in place where a kid who at age 8 was showing some promise, you know, there was a natural step to say, okay, hey, a coach identifies a kid and goes, this kid's got something. Let me see if I can challenge him or her. And there's a natural progression that this kid makes. It goes to another, you know, to another club or to another league within the area. And if the kid succeeds there, there's a next step. And if the kid doesn't succeed, well, then, you know, they stay there or they move down almost like a minor league baseball system. I think the key is, again, Chris brought this up, is it's access to the game, but access to the game at a quality level. It's the idea that, you know, clubs, counties, localities have access to good fields, to good referees, which is a highly under-talked about aspect to it's a highly untalked about trouble with youth soccer these days is the inability to retain referees. And it's not necessarily the referee's fault. But to, you know, have good game management, to have good coaches, to have support from U.S. soccer, and to have this natural pathway for these kids like they do in other sports to progress up to the highest levels. You know, I was thinking as you all were talking, it's kind of like the exact opposite problem that Major League Baseball had. You know, for years and decades, Major League Baseball had these scouts who were making peanuts that would just go to, you know, these local high school games in the middle of nowhere just to see if, you know, there was a kid or two there they could see before another team could and, you know, go out and try and sign them or draft them. But there was a lack of infrastructure for kids in certain parts of the country to play baseball, and baseball suffered because of that. They suffered a lot of geographic diversity. Soccer has the exact opposite problem where there is now – increasingly access to the game. You know, you can play soccer if you live in the densest of cities, the most wide open of rural spaces, you know, but there aren't as many scouts who are connected to the highest levels that are going out to see you. So it's kind of interesting how these sports are now, we could learn, you know, soccer could learn something from baseball, but at the same time, learn what not to do from baseball. So that's something that kind of struck me as you all were talking. It's an inverse of a problem that another popular U.S. sport has.
Robert, you should know by now it's always the referee's fault. No.
You know, I am the son of a 40-plus-year-old referee, so I always know that it is everyone but the referee's fault. That's a lesson he taught me.
Anyway.
Never the referee's fault.
Yeah, your dad wants to, you know, referees union and all that crap. No, that doesn't count here. Sorry. So I want to pass this along to you guys. And, you know, we've always heard about, you know, shouldn't a certain club that develops a kid, shouldn't they get, you know, compensated for, you know, the time one of their players gets purchased or sold to a bigger club within the area? Well, you know, I think Robert knows who I'm going to be going towards because I think you've talked to my friend over in Rhode Island. This is a friend of mine who went to high school with my best friend. My best friend and I are originally from the Bronx, New York, and him and his parents moved to Westchester County, which is the first suburb north of New York City, the five boroughs. And he went to high school with my best friend, and we developed a friendship. Now, you know, he was a player himself a long time ago, Rhode Island Stingrays, then didn't do much in the professional ranks, but that's okay. Back in the day, went to work for the New England Revolution, then that didn't work out for him, and he stayed within the Rhode Island community, especially living over in Providence. and he created Project Goal. I've had him on my show before. Basically, he helps the inner city youth and the surrounding suburban neighborhoods and you know, around inside and outside of Providence, Rhode Island, and basically giving the kids education of regular school work as well as, you know, playing soccer. And the greatest thing just happened. And let me go ahead and get it. And here it is. Apparently, the New England Revolution signed a midfielder named Damian Rivera as a homegrown player. Now, obviously, he is from the New England Revolution Academy. But before that, he was with Bayside FC in Rhode Island as well. But before going to Bayside FC, Mr. Damian Rivera started his soccer career for Project Goal with my friend Darius Shazadi. And, you know, I'm very proud of not only this kid, I guess, going through the rigors and the, you know, the emotions that he had to go through just to become a professional soccer player and now being a part of the New England Revolution, but for him to come out of Project Goal to become a professional soccer player is just absolutely tremendous. Very happy for this kid that his dreams have come true, but at the same time, I'm proud of my friend Darius, who was able to begin, you know, this kid's career, if you want to call it that, I guess, but to begin his career as a professional soccer player by starting him in his Project Goal organization. Gentlemen, I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, Chris, you want to go first? And
yeah, no, I'll.
Yeah.
It's awesome. The more programs we have nationally, you know, addressing access in underserved communities and for underserved, you know, groups of kids, the better. The more stories we're going to hear about that. You know, actually, the reason why I was late to the call was because every Friday we do free futsal, you know, for the kids in the neighborhood. We've been doing it for over 4 years now, and we do it from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock. So, you know, I got it, you know, after I got finished and got everything cleaned up, I came and called in. So, you know, hopefully one of these days, one of these kids that are playing with us every Friday will be a story just like that, and I'll sit back and I'll be like a, you know, a proud grandpa that I helped, you know, made something happen for one of these kids. And I'm proud for your friend, you know, for having this program and having, you know, kids taking full advantage of the opportunity put in front of them, you know, to have this happen. And, you know, we need things like that nationally, you know, in every community, and they're not going to be top-down initiatives. You know, these are going to have to be initiatives that come from the community for the community. You know, that's the way I feel about those. I know a lot of people ask, you know, why doesn't the Federation spend millions of dollars doing this? Like, you know, parachuting in, thinking that you can fix a community isn't how you're going to be able to do it. You know, giving the community the tools to help itself is what's going to have to happen. And, you know, I'm glad to hear this success story. I'm going to need you to send me some more information about it because I want to read.
No problem at all. This is from the New England Revolution website, Twitter page. So you can go to New England Revolution or NE Revolution, at NE Revolution, and you can check it out yourself. And the best thing about this Project Goal by my friend, every year FIFA recognizes the job that Darius Shazadi and his team does with this Project Goal organization. It is a non-for-profit organization, and FIFA gives them a grant every year because of the amazing job that him and his staff has done to not just get these kids, you know, off the streets, get them thinking about schoolwork, get them to thinking about, you know, playing soccer. I mean, obviously not every kid that goes there will have a career in soccer. I mean, you know, there's police. They become police officers, firefighters, doctors, nurses, you know, educators, But there are those that have, you know, tried to become a professional soccer player, and this is the one guy, the one kid that I know of that has made it to MLS, beginning with Project Goal, obviously going on to other youth academies, including the New England Revolution's Academy, Robert. But now he's the first full-fledged, in my book, or in my knowledge, going from Project Goal all the way to MLS.
Yeah, and I followed Project Goal for a couple of years on your recommendation, and you know your story, and this is a great story. I mean, they do great work up there. You know, working with kids, like as you said, might not have an opportunity otherwise to even think about, you know, playing professionally. And so I hadn't heard about this success, so I'm very glad to hear it. I think it's, you know, well deserved for the program. So to go back to your question about, you know, does a group like Project Goal or a club deserve some sort of payment, back reward for developing a player who moves on to make a lot of money for a club? You know, this is one of those things where I don't have a strong opinion because I can see both sides of the argument. You know, on one hand, you have a club that spends time teaching a kid how to play soccer. I mean, that is, we've talked about the investment on the parents and the player side, but you know, we haven't talked about the investment on the club side as well. And you know, these kids that are developing, the Christian Pulisic of the world, the numerous others that go on to make a lot of money. I mean, they're investing money in fields and in coaches and supports, all this stuff. They're spending a lot of money to teach these kids the skills that they need. On the other hand, my concern would be that if there was, you know, a payment structure for when a kid moves on from the second or third level and the clubs are rewarded financially for this, does it change the way that they train soccer players? Is the focus on simply, you know, pouring resources and money into the small handful that will pay for operations? And I'm not saying all clubs would do this, but would some clubs focus on three or four players that are going to pay for the operations expenses for the year at the expense of other players? You know, does it change the way that players are developed in some of these clubs? And also, does it change if there is a payment structure? Does that tighten the U.S. Soccer Federation's grip on the development academy, where players who are inevitably going to move on, if they're playing in the U.S., are going to play for an academy team, an MLS academy team, and so the money stays within that pot? So that's a long answer to say I don't have an opinion or an answer on this, because I can see both sides of this, and I can see the right and wrong arguments on both sides of this debate.
Yeah, definitely there. So I want to get back to our U.S. youth national teams. And Chris, I'm going to go with you first here, because we've already mentioned, you know, the disappointment of the under-17s in this World Cup. And we're not blaming the kids. I just feel that the head coach of the under-17s did not properly set them up, or at least prepare them to play the proper way, because right now, I don't know who Rafael Wicky is. I don't know where he came from. I don't know what his expertise is as a coach, either leading men or leading boys into battle when you are facing top talent from around the world. Now that Tab Ramos, gentlemen, and Chris, we're still going to go with you first here. Tab Ramos is no longer with U.S. Soccer. He is now the head coach of the Houston Dynamo of MLS. We have Jason Kreiss, who is going to be leading players, youth players that are 23 years of age or younger, into the Olympic qualifiers of CONCACAF for the Summer Games in Tokyo, Japan. I am worried. I shouldn't be worried with Kreiss, but I am worried about who is going to take over the under-20s from Tab Ramos. And I'm also worried about, is Wicky still the man for another under-17 qualifying cycle and tournament to go forward? Because the truth is this. Tab Ramos shines when the under-20s in the last 3 to 4 under-20 World Cups has, you know, qualified and has been, you know, a moment of brilliance to see our under-20s qualifying and advancing into the quarterfinals for the last 4 under-20 tournaments. You cannot get any better than what Tab Ramos has done for the kids that are probably 1 or 2 steps away from being a part of professional clubs, or at least are a part of professional clubs, yet they're being given an opportunity to really shine on the international stage. Where do you feel on that there, Chris?
You know, currently we have unfilled positions still in the youth national team setup on both the men's and the women's side. And, you know, it's disappointing that at this juncture, we still haven't filled these positions. You know, I read a quote from Ernie Stewart, you know, recently, where he was talking about creating a new organizational chart and just all kinds of stuff. It's just mind-blowing to me that we can't fill these positions with high-quality coaches that know, you know, that are interested in finding the best kids and helping get them, you know, to play great soccer. And it's wasted time and it's wasted camps. It's wasted opportunities because if I'm not mistaken, now I might be wrong here, but y'all can correct me if I am. But I recall reading that currently the teams that don't have permanent coaches assigned to them are having different DA coaches coach every camp. I mean, there's no way that is, you know, optimum for our youth national team setup. I mean, there's just absolutely no way. And there needs to be the pressure applied from the federation, one to Ernie Stewart, to find coaches. You know, and if the requirement of you have to move to Chicago to be a youth national team coach is that big of a hindrance to finding permanent coaches of the quality that U.S. soccer needs to develop world-class players, then we need to get rid of that requirement. You know, you hear that rumor all the time that's one of the reasons why certain coaches will not, you know, coach in the youth national team setup. And if it's that big of a problem, then we need to remove that requirement and move forward and find the coaches that we need for both the men's and the women's side.
And I agree with that, Robert, because, you know, this is getting to the point where, look, I want to give these coaches a fair shot. We want to see our kids, you know, performing well. And, you know, my feeling is with this under-17 squad, Raphael Wicki put a lot of kids out of position. I felt they just were put out of position going with a game plan with the certain type of tactics he wants, and it's just not working. You're seeing these kids getting blitzed. You're seeing these kids losing the ball, getting stripped really bad, really, really badly getting stripped. And as soon as Tab Ramos left U.S. Soccer, because obviously, you know, look, he wanted a bigger and better opportunity. He got that with the Houston Dynamo. But now you wonder who is going to take over the under-20s. And the question is, are we going to have a coach that either is going to go with what the national team is going to be doing, or will this coach instill his own tactics and his own formations? Because it's just getting harder and harder to stomach this, Robert. It's just getting very difficult. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. You've certainly, that was a point that needed to be finished. I think you're talking about a federation that took a year to hire its senior team coach. I mean, how much faith can you have in them to get the youth coach right? I mean, the Federation consistently, actually on the men's side, I'll say, on the women's side, they show some speed on some positions, important positions, but really fails to hire people in a timely manner and with a clear mandate as to what they do and a clear delineation of responsibility. So, you know, while the U-17 coach or the U-20 coach is not the person who's ultimately responsible for setting, you know, goals and metrics for the Soccer Federation and all the clubs, I mean, the scattershot hiring throughout the Federation is worrisome enough that I really I don't want to be as cruel to say lack the faith, but I'm, you know, I don't really have great expectations for the next coach that's going to come into the U-20s or what's going to happen with the U-17s or whatever. I mean, a lot of these coaches that are being hired, at least in the past, and administrators are being hired within the family. These are people who are well known to U.S. soccer, either as former players or you know, who have an involvement there. And, you know, I think that's what you're going to see more of in these youth soccer hires are people who are familiar to the Federation. And then, you know, what does that mean in terms of creativity? What does that mean in terms of thinking outside the box? What does that mean in terms of bringing in new ideas? And what does that mean in terms of changing the culture for U.S. soccer? You know, my guess is it's going to be a lot of the same old, same old. And because, you know, Daniel, you follow this stuff religiously, and, you know, others of us follow, you know, these youth tournaments religiously. There's a good, solid group of soccer fans in this country that'll watch the U-17 World Cup, but the majority of fans won't. And, you know, I think that allows U.S. soccer to make decisions and just kind of, you know, not face as much criticism because, you know, when it goes wrong, because it's not top of mind for a lot of people. But when things go wrong at the senior level, you know, you see the reason why in things like the U-17 World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely. And Chris, like we've said already, I mean, Jason Kreis is going to take over, which he already has, actually. He's going to be leading with the Olympic qualifying tournament that's coming up on the 20th of March. And the final will be on April Fool's Day. Well, let's not say that too loudly. You know, and you're wondering, you know, what do we feel that these kids that are going to be chosen, you know, I mean, look, I don't have any problems with Chris, with Jason Kreis. I think he's a very solid, you know, manager in MLS. We don't know how he's going to be with these kids, but, you know, look, if he's handled some of these kids that came up from Real Salt Lake back in the day, or, you know, maybe with, you know, MLS, the NYCFC, it was only for that 1 year, though, unfortunately, but still, though. I mean, do we have enough faith in Jason Kreis to go out there and say, well, he's going to be the one to get us qualified for the Olympics for the first time in a very long time? Because it's been, what, 3, 4, 5 Olympic qualifying cycles in a row that we have not gotten to the big dance, whether it be in Norway or South Korea or, you know, Atlanta or, you know, Lillehammer, you know, wherever it is, you know, we haven't had it. And right now it's Tokyo, Japan, that's up next.
You know, what about U.S. soccer instills confidence in you? Nothing. I mean, you know, I hope for the best. You know, I hope that we call in the most talented players, and I hope that they're able to develop great chemistry and they play with passion, desire, talent, and skill, you know. But what about U.S. soccer, the way that they're doing the men's side, you know, what instills confidence in you? You know, nothing currently is instilling confidence in me from the full senior team. I mean, you know, down through the youth teams, I don't know any other way to say it than that. I mean, I agree totally with you that, you know, I'm not confident. I hope for the best, but I am not confident that we're going to deliver the kind of results that the fans of U.S. soccer desire with this Olympic team.
And the only thing is this. Of course we want these kids to succeed. Of course we want these kids to qualify. We want to see Jason Christ succeed. We want our national soccer program, whether it be the professional level, the senior side, or the youth teams, we want to see them succeed. We want to see how much they've progressed. And now they're getting an opportunity to not just be in regional qualifying for the Olympics, but we want to see them actually do well, to get out of the group stage and have that big run to the final, at least to challenge for a medal. Challenge for a medal. I mean, look, gentlemen, gold is always number one on everyone's minds. But if this national team can qualify for the Olympics and get on a run, get on a fantastic run, we will praise the Federation. We will praise these kids. We will praise Jason Christ and everything that comes with it. We want to. I want to. But it's just getting more and more difficult because sometimes we don't know how many heads the Federation has, and we don't know if one head knows what the other one is doing, Robert. And that's just the sadness of it.
Yeah, and I agree with you. You know, we always, I think it's safe to say all of us want the U.S. soccer teams, you know, youth soccer teams, men's and women's, and senior soccer teams, men's and women's, to win. You know, a gold medal is wonderful. We certainly are rooting for that. But I think we always have to be careful of, you know, if the U.S. were to win a gold medal in this Olympics, let's say they do, certainly we would be celebrating and happy, but we can't keep – we've got to keep the narrative in front of us, which is, one tournament success does not mean all of our problems are over.
No, absolutely not.
You know, I'm not going to say it's easy to win a tournament, but it's harder to win two or three and to continue to build off of that. So I certainly think that, you know, we're going to root for the U.S., but we want to make sure that if there's success, how do we build off of that? And I think that's the next key step for U.S. soccer, is to learn what they did right and to be strong enough to admit what they've done wrong in the past or even in this tournament and make, you know, continue to make changes. I'm not optimistic about that part, but, you know, hope springs eternal.
Well, that's the hope, isn't it, that it does spring eternal. And, gentlemen, as we're about to wind down with the time, I'd like your final thoughts, if you could, please. We'll go with Chris first.
Well, you know, thanks for having me on again. You know, I love coming on the show, and, you know, the discussion tonight was great, and I just hope that as a nation, as fans of the U.S., you know, men's and women's national teams, that we can continue to call for these changes that we want to see without the pressure on your local association, your local league, your, you know, local leadership. We're never going to have the pressure at the top, because people have to remember that if your child plays soccer in the United States, that you are a part of U.S. soccer. You're a very small piece of it, and your voice does matter. And don't be scared to speak up and to ask for change. And when we have enough voices speaking and asking for the same thing and calling for change, that's when we're going to start to see it. Just never forget that you are the United States Soccer Federation. We all are. Everybody, every fan, every parent, every player, every coach, every referee, we're all part of the federation. And continue to speak up and speak the change that you want to see into action.
Robert?
Yeah, again, thank you for having me on. This is a wonderful conversation. I know it veered into some depressing areas, but I think it's an important conversation to have. I'm going to take what Chris said and put a slightly different spin on it, which is something I said, I believe, last time I was on the show, which is things look dark and depressing when we look at the way that the Soccer Federation is run right now. But I think when you look at the grassroots level, at the state level, at the club level, there are so many smart, good minds in the U.S. in soccer right now. And there's so much money and resources in this country for the game of soccer, that the change we are going to see for the better is going to come from people like Chris, from the state administrators, the club administrators, and people who are out there trying to make the game better for their communities every day and have a voice in U.S. soccer. And so eventually we're going to see change because of people at the local level, parents, administrators, coaches who are making that difference every day and want to see that difference reflected in the overall game in this country. So while at times I'm, you know, depressed or not, you know, optimistic about what's going on currently, I am optimistic about the future of the sport in our country because there's so many great minds and so many resources that we're going to do better in the future simply because we have the people there to help us do better.
Absolutely. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. Have a good evening, and I will talk to you both again very soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And this will do it for tonight's show, special edition of the 40 Teams Fire American Soccer Show. We want to see our youth national teams succeed, and that's the hope. So we'll have to wait and see what's going to happen with the Olympic qualifying, and hopefully they will qualify for the Summer Games this summer in Tokyo, Japan. For Chris Kessel, the West Virginia State Soccer Association, for Robert Hay from SoccerMinnows.com, my name is Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you very much for listening tonight. And as always, please enjoy your football. Thank you. Have a good night, everybody. Take care. So long. And bye-bye for now.